Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Tim Dene to talk about his latest project, Blades 68, where he serves as the game designer, writer, graphic designer, layout artist, cartographer, and illustrator. Tim, that's a lot of things. Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Jonah, thanks for having me. What an honor.
It's good to have you.
Very good to have you.
Yeah, we're big fans of your work. We wanted to have you on specifically to do a deep dive on Blade 68, this upcoming project you have, going into this new imagining of like what is a very beloved game, what you've changed, what you've introduced, and ultimately how you wear all these hats in making the project.
So our
first question is, how do you do that? How do you wear all those hats?
The hat wearing?
Do you stack them? What is it?
You know, the honest answer is one hat at a time. I'm a pretty strict one hat at a time kind of person. So I do actually think about that. I don't know if I picture hats all the time, but I definitely like get into the role of, layout or design. And then that's all I'm thinking about really when I'm wearing that hat. And then having, finished a certain piece of design or layout, putting on maybe an art director kind of perspective and then thinking, is this coherent with the rest of what I've done so far? Does this kind of meet that art direction goal that I have? Yeah, so I do think that's kind of important. I think Avery Alder's talked about this as well, like being able to compartmentalize each role. And when you're doing that thing, you're just doing that thing. And because if you try to think about, especially as someone with a lot of hats, if you try to wear every hat at once, well, where's the metaphor? I guess all the hats fall off.
They're going to fall off your head.
Yeah, exactly.
It is, we always love, we have a lot of great conversations on this show, sometimes with people who like specialize in one specific aspect. Sometimes we have conversations with people who do it all, just like you were doing. And I'm excited to dive into, especially a project this big, and like, as Elliot was saying, like a take on something so beloved, to have like a semi like auteur person at the forefront of it. I'm excited to talk more about it. Though the problem is, the second you do all the hats, you can't blame anybody else when you don't like something.
Well,
you can't blame the intern.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the advantage of wearing a lot of hats, at least for me, is, especially on a project of this size, I've found that if I've been writing for a few weeks, at the end of that, I'm just really sick of writing. And so to be able to like, it's for me, it's a little reward or a treat.
I say this to Elliot or to my wife all the time. Like, I don't want to do work. I'm going to do this other work. That's the fun
exactly.
Work now.
Yeah. It's good screen, bad screen, but it's good work, bad work. The trick is that every work feels good at first and then it starts to feel increasingly bad. And then you trick yourself by going to the new thing and that's the good one. But yeah, for me, it works really well.
It's one of those things where you would think burnout might be worse if you're doing everything, but it sounds like this might help you avoid that even.
Yeah, for sure. I think so. Well, knock on wood. I guess you never know when burnout will strike. But at least so far, for sure. Yeah, like I do burn out on, illustration, for example, when I've been going hard on that. And it does, it feels like starting fresh to move into a different thing. And I have worn a lot of different hats on that. And so that allows, it's like crop rotation. Like there's so many hats that I'm cycling through. By the time I get back to the writing hat, I've already moved through like 8 different other hats. So that original hat has refreshed.
When we were prepping for this interview, we were going through, you sent us over like a text copy of Blade 68. We were kind of looking through it and we realized something midway through that is unique about this game. That We've talked to a bunch of people on this show about like second editions, like, second edition of whatever game. And that's like a remake of the game, but it's largely the same. We've talked to a number of people who use Forge in the Dark to make like Wild Sea or Slug Blaster or Girl by Moonlight. Blade 68 straddles the line between those two things and is actually, I think, the only game I can think of that I would consider not a supplement, not a hack, but rather like a reboot in the way that like 1960s Ocean's 11 now gets remade in 2001. It's like, it's the same at its core with a whole new face on it. I'm curious how you think about Blade 68 as a project.
Yeah, I think that does kind of hit the nail on the head. Like it is a supplement. You do need to be familiar with the core Blades rules to play it. Like it doesn't have the core procedures in there, but there's quite a lot there, and it's, yeah, I feel like supplement or expansion doesn't quite, it's kind of like a game implement or a game expansion or something. it is kind of in between those things. Intentionally, the projects had many different forms, and at times we did look at a standalone game version, and at times it was much more of a supplement with much less sort of mechanical stuff in there. I think the problem with the standalone is this is a Blades in the Dark thing. It is very much about DOSFall, and it is kind of a love letter to the original Blades. So for it to be its own whole different game, that doesn't feel right. Like it needs to have that relationship. It needs to be in concert with Blades. If there's ever a Blades in the Dark second edition, this will continue to be compatible. You know, it's walking in step with it. At the same time, if it was purely sort of setting like a 90s splat book or something, I think, as you say, the concept, part of the core concept is to be as different from Blades as we think about it as possible. And so that kind of asks for a bit more than just a few lore write-ups and some new pictures, if you know what I mean. Like it is kind of part of the appeal of the whole thing is the sort of extreme contrast with classic Blades.
Yeah, you said you used the word love letter in there, and it was something that I was going to say, is that this game is so clearly imbued with a love of the original material of Blades in the Dark. And like one of those things that is interesting, we talked to, you know, Jess Levine a while ago about adaptational media, and this is a little different than like adaptation in that way, but I'm curious, what is it you love about Blades, and then what is it that you were like, I think it needs this, that led to this?
I mean, the things I love, I guess firstly, the kind of thing that made me fall in love with Blades in the first place wasn't really exactly the setting in the first instance, because I actually didn't have much background with many of the Touchstones. Like I hadn't played Thief or Dishonored, and I wasn't a big sort of gas lamp industrial fantasy fan. But the game design, and especially the way the city is presented, I think is really clever and quite revolutionary for the time. You know, it's not just screeds of paragraphs about everything. It's quite cleverly woven through. The district write-ups are structured in a way that's very usable at the table, but it all sort of adds up to this very coherent picture. It's kind of, I think of it as like a grab bag. Like you don't have to memorize everything about the city, but you can kind of grab a fist in there and pull up like five factions in a district, and you'll get a kind of unique experience. And so I really love that about the original Blades. I love that DOSFall ends up being so compelling, in part because every time you play a game, you spin up your own version of it. So it always feels kind of personal to each group, and yet it's sort of shared across us. And, you know, I think the best games, you may not care about the Touchstones, but you fall in love with the game, and then you sort of explore the Touchstones from there rather than vice versa. And that happened with me, and I did play Dishonored and read the things recommended, and, you know, I love that stuff. So that's kind of my journey of falling in love with Blades, if you like. But then for this project, it's kind of like how, you know, it's every time you play a campaign or even just read a game book, you invest as a GM, you invest, or a player, you invest so much of your energy and memory and everything, reading all this stuff, creating your own version of it. You're emotionally invested. You've memorized all these places. And, you know, I could cite off all 12 districts of DOSFall, which is completely useless information in the real world, but it's taking up actual brain space. And so it's like, there's kind of like a recycling or composting question. Like, can we take all this and then have a new experience that somehow reuses all that kind of brain matter that I've devoted to it, rather than starting afresh for every game, building on something existing? And I think the goal was to have a completely, well, not completely, but quite a different, fresh experience that grew out of existing material that I was kind of personally invested in, and I think many other people are invested in and have experiences of. And I think that does add a lot of depth depth to the experience. Even if you never travel back in time 100 years, or even if you don't reuse characters from your old campaign or whatever it is, you can kind of, I feel like there's like a feeling, a sort of a je ne sais quoi, like a, there's some kind of depth there or flavor, if you like.
I saw on the touchstones for both Blade 68 and for one of your other games, Deathmatch Island, is one of my all-time favorite pieces of media, which is The Prisoner.
Hmm.
And I'm curious, as you were beginning this and you were like looking at touchstones and you were like trying to figure out where, like what this project would become, where, what was like the initial starting point of like the seed of an idea? And also like, what was the initial scale of this project? Because I'm looking at the PDF that we have in front of us now and it's 445 pages. It's a chunky guy. Was that always the plan, or did it start as something smaller and just, it, as these things do, snowballed into something much, much bigger?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a great question and slightly embarrassing, but I remember I had this weekly check-in with another game designer, Greg Soper, and just about whatever game design projects we were working on. I remember talking to him when I had this idea for Blade 68, and I kind of pitched it to him before I talked to anyone else about it. And I remember saying, I'm going to keep this as small as possible. This is the kind of thing I'm going to get done in a few weeks and just ship it. I just feel like I have to do it, but I really don't want to like let the scope get out of hand. I really just want to, I need to put this out in the world, but I'm going to make it in the simplest, smallest version of itself possible. And obviously I've completely failed. That's totally gone. Like 3 years
and,
later.
And we're so happy that you did.
I mean, the original idea, obviously there's a lot of Deathloop in here, so I was playing Deathloop at the time, and I think it's fair to credit that for the sort of spark of or thought of what if we return to a kind of 19th century industrial fantasy with the 60s, what's the 60s version of that setting look like? And thinking about how that would look for Blades was really exciting to me and felt like something I had to see. I mean, the funny thing about Deathloop, although it did trigger the idea, that's actually a very small game, which is a strength of it, right? But it all takes place on an island and it doesn't tell you much about the world beyond that. So I guess I would say, I hope it's a lot more than just a Deathloop game now, but I do have to credit that game with the inspiration there.
I had just one follow-up for that. Because, I mean, we opened this by listing off, you know, you are game designer, writer, graphic designer, layout artist, cartographer, illustrator. When you first conceived of this idea, was one of, were you, which hat of those were you wearing? Did this come from like a visual idea? Did this come from a game mechanic idea? Did this come from a storytelling idea? Like, what was that moment for you?
At the time, I wasn't aware. It just was an idea that set my brain on fire and it's like, I have to do this. But if I was to look back, I would say there was kind of two hats that really excited me about that. One was just as a GM, which I think the best idea is like I just wanted to play it or run it. So it was less about making the product and more I want to run this campaign, which I think adds a kind of, yeah. I think the best stuff is like the stuff you make for yourself because you're excited to actually play it at the table. Not necessarily because you think it'll be a great product or whatever, you know. So that was a big part of it. And then, yeah, alongside that was, I guess, the graphic design hit. Like I knew I love mid-century design. I've done a lot in the area. I felt confident I could do something, or I felt confident I could have a lot of fun doing the visual design for this game. And then the third hat really, which is a funny one, is the kind of cartographer map-making hat. Because the first thing I did, I have these DOSVOL detailed street maps for Blades in the Dark, which are for classic Blades, right? Original Blades, all in black and white. And the very first thing I did when I was thinking about 60s Blades was I realized I could just take those maps and kind of do a cool 60s color version of them. And that was actually the very first thing I did for Blade 68 was to sit down and figure out the 60s map styling, put everything in color and start to think through some of the like world building around it. Like one of the earliest sort of thoughts was Blades has the lightning barriers, right? And I realized that that feels great for industrial fantasy. It doesn't feel very 1960s or 60s. So I had to replace those. So I thought about this idea of like a bubble force field. So I drew a big circle on my map. And then a circle, when overlaid onto DOSFall, creates more land because the lightning barriers don't draw a circle. So it creates extra areas. Then I had to come up with new districts to fill the area. And so then the ball's rolling, like you're thinking. So it sort of starts with cartography and map making and graphic design, but that has implications into what are we going to do in terms of world building. And yeah, it all kind of grew from there.
I remember the maps was the first wind I caught of this as a project. Was I think that you were posting them in threads on Blue Sky, or maybe even it was Twitter at the time. I'm not sure. Yeah. And just being like, just the first maps being like, this is Duskfall 100 years later, and it being like, oh, I didn't even think you could do that. That's awesome. I can't wait to see where this goes. So I feel like kind of from there, I want to maybe start windowing some of these changes for folks that you like that have been introduced, like what Duskfall and this world and gameplay looks like 100 years later. I guess from a real broad standpoint, what is the kind of storytelling people do in Blade 68 that differs from what they did in original Blades? Like, what are these characters? What are they doing?
At a high level, it is a Blade supplement, and I wanted to keep the core Blades gameplay loop. So you are still criminals. It's a game about a crew of criminals in a constrained city trying to build their criminal empire. There are similar crew types. So you might be dealers, not necessarily drug dealers, but some kind of dealers. You might be assassins, like a hit squad. You might be a heist team, shadows, all this kind of thing. So in that sense, similar Blades activities, right? But I think where the differences come in, so the first visual difference is you notice it's all in color, obviously. And so now there's like a fake daytime to justify that color. There are like fake blue skies. And so that starts to flow into, you know, it's funny, originally I wasn't going to have fake daytime, but I shared these color maps and people were like, oh, has Blades got daytime now? I was like, oh, I guess it should have daytime now. Yeah. Yeah, I guess it does. I guess that makes sense. And so that really flows through again from that sort of design decision. There is a daytime now, and that means there's a certain amount of optimism in the setting. It's, I would say, less kind of, I don't know if grimdark's the right word, but I mean, original Blades is a setting of eternal night, right? Which is pretty, pretty gothic. Yeah, pretty dark, literally. So now there is this daytime. It's the 60s, so there's political movements, there's upheaval, there is a movement for change. There's a certain optimism, both institutionally, in terms of like it's a post-war period, so things are rebuilding and there's new technologies, but also in terms of political movements and labor movements and this kind of thing, there is that sense of optimism, right, which is quite different to Blades. And so as a Blade 68 crew and as players, I think there is a bit more scope to try and influence that stuff and to build on it. And I'd say in general, to go with sort of full color daytime thing, it's a little bit more of a hijinks game. I mean, Blades has a lot of hijinks at most tables, but I think Blade 68 leans into that a little bit more. It's a little bit lighter, a little bit more hectic. So there's kind of a tonal shift there. I think the important thing I would say is that I wanted to be true to kind of the underlying truth of the setting, which is that underneath all that, it is still, there's still the cataclysm beyond the bubble. It is still a place of eternal night. Like in, you know, in the 60s, there's that Hunter S. Thompson quote in Fear and Loathing where he says this. I think 68 was the high watermark when the wave of kind of leftist, like this kind of building momentum, the wave broke and rolled back, and that was the high tide. And so there is kind of a sense in Blade 68 in a similar kind of way that this might be as good as it gets. Like there's literally a bubble. The bubbles pop is the thing. So there's a kind of the sense of building optimism, but also I think a fun question for each group and for the table is you know, is this, are we going to return to the sort of horrors of the eternal night, or is this going to be capitulated into some kind of like sci-fi Big Brother 1984 setting? Like, can we actually, the flame of optimism is fragile, you know?
Yeah, it's where my brain goes initially thinking about like, a fake day night cycle. My brain is like, well, who's in charge of the fake day? And like, how are they using that to, you know, fuck the rest of us?
Totally. And there's also a sort of a Truman Show aspect where there's something even more unsettling about a fake sky, a fake daytime to me. Like, ostensibly, very nice to have blue skies, but knowing that it's a fake blue sky adds a sort of hyper-reality, and yes, this intentionally sort of unsettling quality to that, I think.
As you were playtesting this game, so you get the kind of a first version out, you start to like figure out what this is. What did you learn about the setting that you learned through like playtesting and figuring it out that you didn't know going into those like first sessions? Do you know what I mean?
With my private group, you mean, or the open playtesting with everyone?
Either, really.
I think just the extent to which, you know, you're designing a game like this and you think, okay, we've got the Shadows crew and they're going to do espionage stuff, and we've got the Dealers crew and they're going to do shady dealing stuff, and the Militant crew are going to do your sort of Black Panther, like militant activism stuff. Black Panthers is in the group, not the superhero. And I sort of had it compartmentalized in my head, but obviously in play, each player picks a character and they make choices that connect to all these different aspects, independent of what the group as a crew chooses. So the crew is kind of interested in one particular facet of the setting, but really with any group of players, they're all going to be attracted to different things. And so you always end up with this real mix of influences and tones and aspects of the setting. Like you'll, in my experience, always have someone who wants to play the politically connected character, the activist or the revolutionary. You'll always have someone who plays the more kind of freewheeling Austin Powers type person, the partier. So you always get this mix. I think the interesting part is it's always in different ratios. So it is always different, but I guess the extent to which all those things had to interconnect and be able to work alongside each other in every game rather than as sort of siloed, like you're playing a political game or a party game or whatever it is.
One of my favorite things in the times I've played Blades, I always love to play like a real freak who is like, you know, connected to Leviathans or connected to demons or connected to ghosts. And in this like brighter, more optimistic Duskfall, I'm so curious where the weird landed of the Duskfall setting. Where are the Leviathans? Where are the ghosts? What are they up to in this 100 years later version of Duskfall?
That's sort of a fun part of it, is that I guess, as I said, I would sort of describe the optimism and the modernism of the setting as like a veneer, and all the old stuff is still there. And so when you come in as a player and you're familiar with classic Blades and you're interested in that stuff, you just get to instantly be the person who is the kind of conspiracy head who's like, you know, wake up, sheeple, there's like, you know, they're trying to tell you that Section 6 is trying to tell you that ghosts are gone, but there's all this shit going on. And the thing is, you're right. That stuff does still exist. It's just been kind of papered over. And I think, yeah, again, that's kind of the benefit of this being like an expansion. If you're coming at this fresh, you kind of have to understand the official narrative of no ghosts and then the truth that there is ghosts and the different ways people think about that. But if you're familiar with classic Blades, you know the old fairy tales, you know what's been buried. And so it's very easy for players to kind of dig that up and to bring it into their games. And I think that's a fun part of things, is that often campaigns start quite straight and modern with very little of that paranormal aspect, but inevitably it just creeps in more and more over time and things get weirder and weirder in a very satisfying organic kind of way.
Hey, you don't look familiar. First time in this part of the city? I see that sneer on your face. Better wipe it off before I do it for you. This is home. This is the best place you could ever want to be. Whether or not this is where you meant to end up, you found yourself on a rather fortuitous street. You see that corner building down there? 3 floors up. Lamplight Investigative Services. Friends of mine, you ask. loaded words you're throwing around this evening. Good people is what they are, though. Not a single one of them will admit to being nice. Something about duty, yada yada. A bunch of BS, if I do say so myself. Who am I? No need to worry your pretty little head about that. I'm sure my name will come up in time. But go, see for yourself, 3 floors up, gold-gilded sign. As for Mama, don't tell him I sent you. She'll know what to do.
All doors are just windows that we can't see through. You ever think about that?
We provide our patrons with anonymity.
Hello, this is Mama Amaretta speaking.
Lamplight Investigations, a Thirsty Sword Lesbian's noir mystery. Full season available now on QueerPG.
There's going to be a lot of GMs and players out there who have played a bunch of Blades in the Dark or other like Forged in the Dark games and now want to give Blade 68 a try. I'm curious, do you have any advice for GMs who are looking to pick up Blade 68 and run it and have just as much fun as they do with Blades in the Dark? Like any things that you think people should lean into or lean away from that might be different from classic Blades?
I would say in general, there's less of that zero to hero thing in Blades. Like you start off with a few more advantages in your court. Tier zero crews in Blade 68 are intentionally less sort of scrappy and up by the bootstraps as Blades in the Dark was. Like Blades in the Dark has this very kind of grim 19th century, like you were, when you're tier zero, you know, you're wearing rags and you have rusty blades and all this stuff. Whereas Blade 68 is intentionally, you start, yeah, with a few more advantages. A tier zero crew is less of an underdog, I would say. And should take less time to kind of claw their way up the ladder. So in that sense, it's a little faster paced out the gate. You're less of the underdog. And as a GM, I'd say just like lean into that and let the players go at full speed. And they should be able to tackle like higher tier factions and get into more trouble more quickly without being completely like squashed. So you kind of just got to roll with that. As I said, I think intentionally the tone is, I sort of wrote down like a mission statement for myself at the start, which was hectic criminal escapades in a retro futuristic dystopia, which was just intended for myself really as like in a sort of a compass type thing. And so that phrase like hectic escapades is kind of key to some of the mechanical changes. And it is meant to be, yeah, a little lighter, a little more like Lupin the Third, then Blades, like a little more driving your car over a chasm and then jumping out and XYZ. yeah. That kind of
There's
thing.
There's cars to drive, first of all.
There are, yeah. There are cars. That's a big change. And then I guess my final piece of advice would be in the post sort of deep, like John Harper released Deep Cuts last year, and that sort of really underlines how modular Blades in the Dark is meant to be. Like there's explicitly advice in there that John encourages you to, if there's a particular subsystem or modular, you should swap it out either for something from Deep Cuts or something you've come up with yourself, or now something from Blade 68. And so I would just encourage people, Blade 68 has a bunch of new subsystems and procedures and stuff that I think work well for the tone it's going for, but you shouldn't be afraid. For sure, like Deep Cut stuff, swap in any Deep Cut stuff you're enjoying, even go back to original Blades if that's your flavor. Like this is really a mix and match kind of mentality, I think.
What are some of those mechanical subsystems you've introduced that are now brand new, and how do they inform the different kinds of play styles that you're introducing with Blade 68? You don't have to go through all of them, but maybe some of your favorites.
Yeah, so one example is, so in original Blades, you can resist each consequence one time. So if you take some harm, that someone stabs you, you can resist that, and that would take it down one harm level usually, and that's kind of your option for lessening that harm. In Blade 68, there's this, you can resist as many times as you want, so you could just keep resisting that and avoid being stabbed at all if you want to keep going back to the well and gambling the stress, which I think just adds to that slightly more bulletproof feeling of the characters, because they can, you know, again, in Blades, if you are stabbed, you will get stabbed. You just might get stabbed less. Whereas in Blade 68, you can avoid the stable together, you can resist things right down. It costs a lot of stress, so it's not free, but that option is on the table. And there is some other stuff like that, like armor is more effective in Blade 68 than it was in Blades. So again, you're a little bit more able to sort of jump off a building and roll down a hill and take on five guys or whatever. So that's kind of on that sort of hectic end of things. Like, you're a little more resilient. And then I guess the other subsystem I'd highlight is the keys and deadlocks system. So in original Blades, you have trauma and you can take up to four trauma conditions and then your character must retire. In Blade 68, that's replaced with, so you start with these keys, which are like character traits, and you get XP for role-playing them. And over time, those keys get turned and become deadlocks, which is like either the intensification or the opposite of that trait. And so there's a little bit more of like role-playing, choosing character traits up front, role-playing to them for a little XP, and then deciding how those character traits change over time. So unlike trauma, which is from a list, you choose your own deadlocks. So if one of your keys was gregarious and you go through a traumatic experience, you might now be shy, or you might be, what's an intensification of gregarious? Completely, like recklessly, you know, running at the mouth at every opportunity. And you get to choose whether it's the intensification of it or the reverse of it. So that's another example of where it's a similar subsystem. It's very modular. You could swap back to trauma if you prefer. But the keys and deadlocks, I think, is just slightly more kind of character-driven play.
And then in terms of like the gameplay cycle of Blades in the Dark, how has that changed or been adapted for Blade 68?
It has been changed a bit. I mean, you still have the basic cycle of downtime into the score. Like, that is still the pendulum that swings around and drives the whole thing. The major changes are entanglements have been, so there's this game called A State by Handiwork Games, and Morgan Davey has something in it called the Trouble Engine, which is a really nice kind of expansion of entanglements, of the trouble your crew gets into. And it's actually quite similar to classic entanglements, but it sort of builds it out into, yeah, well, it's called the Trouble Engine, so you kind of get the you get the feeling of it. So we use that for Blade 68, and so that has been imported. So rather than just rolling for an entanglement every cycle, you run the Trouble Engine, and it's a little bit more involved, but you get more trouble and different kinds of trouble. And I think that's a lot of fun for sort of driving play rather than just a little obstacle between scores. There's a lot of sort of engaging, well, trouble that arises from that. The other big change, so instead of downtime activities into free play, those are kind of interwoven together. So you have this personal business phase where the crew breaks up and they go do their own things, and some of that will be free play where you're just following these characters about their lives, and in amongst that they will do their downtime activities. So that's a little bit more interwoven. And then related to that, two other sort of gameplay cycle innovations that I think are really successful. One is that at the end of each score you have an unwind scene, which can be like just having some drinks at the bar, or doing some meditation, or having a big group argument, or going fishing together. Or, you know, there's a whole list in the book. But at the end of each score, a different player each time chooses how the gang unwinds together. And then you just all describe like what the vibe is and what everyone does. And you clear a little stress and a little harm. I think scores for both the characters, but also the players, can be pretty like tense. And you kind of come out of that quite adrenalized and on edge. And so the unwind scene just gives a chance to like change gears into downtime, into personal business. It also gives a chance for something I have observed in some Blades games, is that during the score, you're so focused on the score, there's not a lot of room for like bantery character interaction. And then during downtime, everyone just buggers off to do their own downtime activities, often separate. Sometimes I kind of miss the interaction and the interplay between the crew members. So unwind scenes are a great way post-score to just get a scene where all the characters are together, releasing stress and a chance to talk about what just happened, what's coming up, and just, yeah, have some good character moments. And so those unwind scenes are some of my favorite campaign moments that I've had. And then the final thing I'd mention is, for score planning, there's like this whole planning meeting little procedure, which is quite a bit more involved, but the gist of it is that every player has to pitch like an idea for a score and the GM as well. And then you put them all on the table and you pick one to do. So that's different from original Blades, where it's much more organic and it's kind of up to the GM. Usually the GM will float one or two opportunities and then the players pick one of those and that's what you're going to do. But I've found sometimes that can be very dependent on the GM. Like, it can feel like a pick a path adventure where the GM says you can do A or B. Whereas this planning meeting is kind of a low stress way to canvas everyone at the table, even the quiet players. Everyone puts forward an idea, like no bad ideas. And then you roll randomly for power and stuff like this and you pick one. But it just means the campaign can go in much more unexpected directions. It feels very player-driven rather than GM-driven, which I think is great for a sandbox like Blades. And it means you get a really nice kind of even... Everyone gets a voice, even the quiet players. And often, you know, I've been delighted that the players who... You know, you always have the players who kind of drive things and make plans. And it's really fun when someone who doesn't usually do that, the crew goes with their idea. And just to have that kind of balanced out a bit is, that's my favorite kind of gameplay moment.
That feels like lessons from like GM-less play and things like that. I really like that.
Yeah, 100%.
One of my favorite parts in really any role-playing book, anytime I see this, I'm always very happy about it. And it exists in Blade 68. Is the player advice section, which I feel like every book has a big chonkin' section on GM advice. And that is one person out of probably four, five, six people playing this game. And I just kind of want to read some stuff back to you because I think it's all really good advice that any player could take. And there are six pieces of advice in Blade 68 for how to have the best time playing this game. And that is go in boots and all, dig the other characters, make the GM sweat, which my players have never failed to do. This one I really like, sell the punches, always choose the bigger reaction, let them be upset, irrational, and emotional, fuck around and find out, also my players have never failed to do, and learn to stop worrying and love the consequences. These are words to live by for anyone playing pretty much any role-playing game. But Tim, I'm curious why you felt it important to add these bits into the book of Blade 68.
I actually feel a bit conflicted about it because I think I even mentioned that in there. I'm just, you know, often speaking only to my own experience as a GM, I convince my players to play some weird game with me and I'm just happy they've agreed and we all get to have this fun time. So I never want to be like, okay, we're playing this game and you must remember to do X, Y, Z, you're playing it badly. Or, you know, I never would want that kind of tone in there. But the advice is very much, I think you will have more fun if you play the game like this. I think there's something I've observed in Blades, having run and played a bunch, is that it is a high tension game, right? Like it's about heists and you literally have like a stress meter. You get stressed out both as a character and as a player. Even when things are going well, there's a lot of tension and that's all great. That's fun. But I think this kind of contrast between the game as this kind of narrative, like dynamic game where you have mixed successes and you want the narrative to go in interesting directions. You don't want the players to plan too much. I think the game system wants the players to be very proactive and exciting and jump across the ledge and do these kind of exciting things. It's not in that kind of like careful OSR style play where you're trying to plan for ages and account for every contingency and be very careful. This is the opposite of that, right? But I think Blades is so good at fostering the atmosphere of the heist movie, like the Ocean's 11. And those movies are all about the tension, right? The stress, the drama. And Blades is so good at fostering that sometimes players believe that too much. They believe they really are in a lot of danger and they have to be very careful. And so I just wanted like a corrective to kind of remind the players that, yes, we're in this tense heist Ocean's 11 scenario, but the game will still be the most fun and is designed for you to be a bit reckless and to move fast and to do all these things that the advice suggests. So I guess I would say, I think all the advice or a lot of it is kind of counterintuitive. So that's why I included it, because I think sometimes players don't arrive at those conclusions naturally.
I think especially this type of advice of like, push yourself to the edge, make the big choice, do the scary thing. So much of media and games is about like, let me see if I can 100% perfect this level. Let me see if I can make this with no mistakes. And a lot of role-playing games, if you make the most mistakes, I don't want to say you're playing it right, but like you're probably getting the most out of the game because that's where it is most rewarding your choices. And it is just very antithetical to what everything else in the world is telling us to do. Nothing else is saying, hey, get to one hit point at all times because it's probably going to be more fun. Everyone else is saying like, hey, try to kill that monster without getting touched.
100%. I mean, the statistically, the most common outcome in Blades is the 4-5 mixed success result where you get what you want, but there's a complication. The game is designed to have that occur more often than not. So as a player, you really have to, I think that's even part of the advice, you kind of have to realize that and embrace it, because otherwise you're just not going to have as much fun if every time you get a 4-5, you're a little bit bummed out, right? If you're only waiting for the sixes, they don't come up that often. So you just have to find the fun in the chaos and the mixed success and the sort of controlled fail forward kind of style of play.
I'm curious, you, like I said before, I'm looking at the PDF here, 445 pages. It's a big chonking thing. Most projects, whenever we talk to anyone on this show, are not done because they are completed. They're done because they're due. I'm curious, is there anything that you didn't put in Blade 68 or like things that you still want to add, either that didn't make the cut, you didn't quite figure out, or might be coming out later because you want to keep making in this world?
Yeah, for sure. I would have loved to do, mainly in terms of like examples and that kind of grab bag idea, like things for the GM and players to like grab a hand in and pull out. I don't want more homework for anyone, but for example, example inventions are in there. I think there's like 4 or 5, and I'd love to have like 20 or 30, because I think they're quite hard to come up with on the spot, and there's no harm in just having a shopping list and players can browse. I think that's fun play, doesn't require homework of anyone, but it's there if you need it. And I think that's the best kind of like game resource. So if pages were infinite, I would have included more of those and a lot of stuff like that. So example, paranormal rituals, more of the cold opens and ticking time bombs, which are kind of the starting scenarios and background situations. There's a whole bunch of those, but I could keep going. So yeah, more of that kind of optional content, I guess you would call it, sort of gameable resources that GMs and players can grab a fistful of if they need it.
I do really love the visual of just reaching into a book and grabbing a fistful of stuff and being like, play with it.
Yeah, like, increasingly that's like my favorite.
Doing today.
It's what I love about, I've been playing Mythic Bastion Land and the way that
that game.
It's so good. And that's exactly like, it's got this, it's not especially fat book, but it's pretty big. There's like a lot of knights and a lot of myths, but you don't have to read them ahead of time. And I have not read them ahead of time because you grab a few when you need them and that's great. And you just leave the rest until you need it.
I've talked about this on this show and on our other podcast, My First Dungeon. It's like an actual play podcast, that when I started playing role-playing games, I was of the mind of like, I got to create everything myself. It's got to all come from my head. Auteur, whatever. And the more I go, the more I'm like, random tables are where it's at. It's because it's not disjointed. I'm presenting you now with a weird and interesting thing that might not fit. The challenge is, hey, players, this fits. We just don't know how yet. Let's all figure it out together. And that's always a fun puzzle to figure out.
Yeah, I think that's the sweet spot, right? Like, it's not the blank page where you're creating everything from scratch, but you still have creative input. You're still taking the parts and assembling them. So you still have that authorship, which I think is fun. Yeah, I think that's a nice sweet spot.
So, Tim, this project is going to print. It's going to be a book. And not only is it going to print, it's going to print with the publisher of Original Blades, Evil Hat. So I'm curious, kind of switching over to the bringing this to life. What is this partnership with Evil Hat? And this is your second time working with them. What does this partner with Evil Hat mean for the project?
Yeah, that's been great to work with them. And it's great for me because I have worked with them in the past, so we know each other well, and we know that relationship can work. So, yeah, very happy to do that. And it feels great that, obviously, you know, they're the home of Blades or whatever. So this kind of that's exciting. I mean, in terms of the projects, as I said, to begin with, you know, I had this idea and I started working on it before talking to John. John Harper obviously owns the IP to Blades, and it's not part of the SRD. So you can't release like DOSVOL Blades in the Dark IP stuff without his permission and, you know, whatever royalty structures, that kind of thing. But I sort of recklessly started working on it before talking to them because I kind of knew, even if that's this rad, doesn't get approved, I'm happy just to put this out as like a bootleg PDF on Google Drive and share it around that way, which I have done before. I did Dogs in the Bark, which is this silly thing about playing dogs in Blades in the Dark. And I never talked to John, and I just put it on Google Drive for free because I figured I don't think John Harper's going to put lawyers on me for that. And they've been very supportive of that, obviously. So I kind of felt like I had the vibe there. So I knew at the very least I could release it for free. And this was the kind of project I would have been happy to do a much simpler version and just put it out for free because I had to do something around it. But I did talk to John about, can I sort of license the IP, if you like, can we release this officially? And he was on board with that. And so then it became a bit more official. And so then I was like, okay, I'll put a bit more work into this. The page count expanded. Now that it's going to be more than a bootleg PDF, I can justify putting a bit more time into it, right? And then I talked to Evil Hat because we already had this working relationship, and I mentioned this project, and they were excited. So then once we kind of figured it out between the three of us, because now it's like a three-way working relationship, like John, Evil Hat, myself, and we worked that out. And so then they agreed to publish it. And then again, that's when the scope expanded again, because now it's like, well, now we're going to do a crowdfund and it's going to be a printed book, not just a PDF I put on my itch. And so now again, I can kind of justify putting more time in, which means more content, which means more pages. So
and more hats.
More hats. Yeah. So I think Evil Hat's involvement, sort of answer your question, is they're to blame for it being 450 pages.
And I know the problem when I see it.
It's always the person with the most hats.
Yeah, no, that is true. But yeah, I think it's going to be a nice book. And obviously, they also bring in, you know, it is not an auteur production, and they bring in editors and sensitivity readers. And Sean has worked extensively as a system consultant, as has John. And so yeah, I think it's a much better, more professional book than it would be otherwise, I guess is what I'd say.
And then you said that this book is going to be doing a crowdfunder. Can you talk about what that, the extent of that crowdfunding project?
Yeah, February 10th, it'll be on BackerKit. And so obviously there'll be the book, the PDF, limited edition cover. We've got some pretty exciting little add-ons that will be exclusive to the crowdfund. I'm really happy with kind of, like, you plan a crowdfund and you come up with all these crazy ideas. I'm really happy with where we've landed, which are things that are very usable at the table. And I think, you know, I think it's a good sign where I'm like excited to get my hands on them for my own game. Like, it's not just some stickers and dice when I've already got enough dice or whatever. Like, so for example, something silly I did was there's like, I forget how many, 40 factions in the book, and I designed a logo and business card for each one of them, which took fucking ages. So I have all these business cards in the book, and we're going to print a deck of cards, and so you can have all these business cards as real cards. And I think that'll be really fun to hold. And they're a great game table prop because Blades is a very faction-based game. So you're always telling the players, you know, you're going up against this faction or this faction are annoyed. So to be able to like take out the business card and have the visual, and each card kind of sells you on the vibe. It adds a lot. So I think that's a really fun thing that will be available through the crowdfund. And the other thing is we're going to do a big A0 folded version of the map. And again, as I said, the map is like foundational to the project and it's where I started. And I think if I do say so myself, it's a pretty cool map. And so to have this big folded subway style map that again, you can unfold on the table, I think that'll be so much fun. So I'm really excited that that will be available through the crowdfund as well.
Are there trains in 1968 Duskfall?
There are trains. There's a monorail.
Love trains. Yeah. I love trains. I don't know. That's just something
that
little
came out
kid
of
in me
nowhere.
Just fucking got me. You said a subway map, and I was like, oh my god, is there a subway system now? That's crazy.
Yeah, I love it too. And you can't beat like a train heist, right?
Yeah, can't beat a train heist. I guess as we're rounding towards a close here, Tim, going all the way back to this idea of you wore all these hats, and hats has been probably the word we've said the most on this podcast. I'm to creators out there who aspire to the kind of creation you do, where it's like, hey, I wanna make the art for the thing I write and do the layout and things like that. Do you have any advice for people who kind of, you know, see this kind of work you're doing and are like, I want to make a game like that?
You know, this is going to sound really hypocritical, but I would say start small. This project started small and expanded slowly. And that's, I think, the best way to do it, especially if you want to wear all the hats, because my kind of rule of thumb is I never know when I'll like fall over or burn out or whatever. So I try to like start with a small circle of an idea and get kind of an MVP done in all aspects. So enough writing, some art, some layout, some character sheets. And then when the scope expands, slightly bigger circle, and then another round of like writing, layout, illustration, art, and expanding that way. And I think that works really well if you're wearing a lot of hats, because I think a big danger can be if I sat down to, because as I say at the start, I tried to keep it as small as possible. I think the initial PDF was like 30 pages, but that had illustration, art, writing. It was sort of a complete 30 pages, right? If I had sat down and said, this is going to be 450 pages, and I tried to just write 450 pages out the gate and then lay out 450 pages and then illustrate 450 pages, I think I would have fallen over somewhere along the line. It just seems like too big a mountain to climb. And so, yeah, I guess to keep the hat metaphor, like just keep rotating those hats. Don't try to wear one too hat too long. It'll get sweaty or something. That's my experience of wearing a hat too long. Yeah, I think that's my advice.
I have in the other room a top hat that I bought when I went to London, and every part of me wishes that it was within reach right now. Every single
we
were, part
we
of
we should
me.
All be wearing hats by the end of this.
We should all
have we should have all worn hats.
And I just changed it in like conspicuously throughout the interview without acknowledging.
Yeah, just as we cut around, just new hat. You know, a visual gag for this mostly audio media.
Yeah.
It's worth it. It's worth it.
And then Tim, I always love hearing about with crowdfunders. You guys gotta have some cool stretch goals. Tell me about what the stretch goals are if this project, as I'm quite sure it will, funds beyond its initial goal.
Yeah, that's maybe one of the things I'm most excited about. We've got a whole bunch of stretch goal contributors lined up. I think something that was so fun about this is Blades, Forged in the Dark has been so successful as a kind of like a SRD system and its own ecosystem that we have like a whole raft of too many really like great Forged in the Dark designers and Blades in the Dark community members who could be stretch goal contributors. So it's not just like friends and known names. They're all people with a like depth of experience with Blades or Forged in the Dark. So I'm really excited to see these people creating Blades 68 content. So the format will be kind of zines. So it's sort of open-ended, but each contributor will either do some art or like an essay or a faction or some fiction or some settings. So all kind of like gameable material on the theme of Blade 68. And we've approached the first like 10 or 15 people and some really great names and exciting stuff they're going to be doing. So yeah, I can't wait to kind of get that out there.
Yeah. Well, I'll be very interested to keep an eye on that page and see how it evolves and what all people are going to be able to get.
So Tim, our final question that we bring to every guest that comes on Talk of the Table is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation for our audience. It can be anything under the sun, in tabletop, out of tabletop. It can be to go take a breath of fresh air right now. Tim Dene, what would you like to bring to the table today?
I would like to bring a book called Tripping on Utopia by Benjamin Breen. It is my favorite book I read last year. I kind of read it as Blade 68 research, but I think even if you have no interest in the 60s or Blade 68 or anything, I think everyone should read it. I think it's such a fascinating book. It's basically about the history of psychedelics in the 20th century, from right the beginning of the 20th century through to the kind of 60s and 70s. And it covers like the early days, like there was this resurgence of interest in traditional psychedelics like mushrooms and ayahuasca and stuff like that. Then the invention of LSD in 1938, early experiments with that, a time period where like Cary Grant did a lot of LSD and raved about how great it was therapeutically. And there was kind of a moment in time, again, sort of talking about these like turning points where it seemed like psychedelics could be the favored like mental health therapy. And there was a lot of like scientific backing about that. But the pendulum swung the other way, and instead they, became, they are not. Yeah. I mean, they've been rediscovered recently, but or sort of re-experimented with, I suppose. But that kind of moment in time where that was a possibility, and all the wild things that happened, like MK Ultra and the CIA experimenting with LSD and thinking it could be involved in, you know, brainwashing people. But then also the more utopian people who experimented with it, who had really like a benevolent vision of it. And then the kind of more manipulative sleazebags like Timothy Leary, and this whole spectrum of colorful characters and amazing stories in it. You know, like in the 70s, NASA funded a program to give dolphins LSD to see if they would learn to talk.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And did they?
They did not. And it's actually quite depressing because it was horrible for the dolphins and many died. But yeah. But the book is just like from start to finish, just so many wild things that happened throughout. And I really, yeah, it's a great read.
We'll put that link in the show notes. Tim, thank you so much for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you? And also, can you remind people where they can back Blade 68?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. This has been a blast. You can find me at www.olddog.games is the website, or olddog.games on Blue Sky. Blade 68, I think if you just Google it, you'll find the back kit, or go to evilhat.com and it will be on there. It's around. It's hard to miss.
And it'll be in the show notes.
Notes, baby. Just click the show notes. Click the link. Hell yes. And if you want more gamey content from us here at Talk of the Table, you can do us a huge favor and become a member of the Many Sided Media Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can get access to ad-free episodes of all of these episodes, plus bonus roundtables, bonus actual plays for our podcast, My First Dungeon. We put out original music. We put out a couple of games that may or may not be playable. There is a ton of stuff over on our Patreon, and it is the thing that is most helpful for making us be able to continue making this show, our other shows, and even maybe some more secret shows this year, because we got a whole bunch of plans that we would love to make with your support. If you want to talk about this episode or any episode of Talk of the Table, become a member of the Many Sided Media Discord. We would love to have you to chat about this game and all the other games out there. We love games. Rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.